The Soviet government reports an accident at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in the Ukraine.
Yes, there's been an accident at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. Okay, well, 25 years ago there was an accident. I'm Carrie Thompson, and on this episode of Playback, we walk a mile in the shoes of April 1986, a month that will make you swear it's the 80s all over again. We'll have the original audio from the Chernobyl disaster, plus an update from NPR's Christopher Joyce. We'll also have the story of the April 86 bombing of Libya, and some off-color tunes from singer Tom Waits.
He sold used office furniture out there on San Fernando Road and assumed a $30,000 loan at 15.25%, put a down payment on a little two-bedroom place.
And to start things off on the right foot or hoof, I'd like to introduce you to a good friend of mine.
Hello, I'm Mr. Red.
A horse is a horse, of course, of course. And no one can talk to a horse, of course. That is, of course, unless the horse is the famous Mr. Red.
On the wire service today, this story from Ironton, Ohio. And we're quoting church members singing Oh, How I Love Jesus, burned record albums, cassettes, and other rock and country music paraphernalia after attending a seminar in which an evangelist said the Mr. Ed television theme conveys a satanic message to unwary listeners. Mr. Ed is the popular television show about a talking horse. At the seminar Tuesday night in Ohio was Pastor Ken Carney of the First Church of the Nazarene in Ironton. He said that after the listening session, a group of 75 teenagers on their own burned more than $3,000 worth of recordings. Pastor Carney said that he himself heard the satanic message in the Mr. Ed theme. You have to play the song backwards, he says, and then you can hear the words, the source is Satan, and also someone sung this song for Satan.
I just want to encourage you to use caution with that demonic Mr. Ed song, because it seems to have unleashed some kind of weird vibe that April.
This is a special report from National Public Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Frank Stasio. In just a few seconds, President Reagan will speak to the nation about the United States attack on Libya this evening. Just over 2 hours ago, U.S. military forces attacked Libya. President Reagan.
Americans, at 7 o'clock this evening, Eastern Time, air and naval forces of the United States launched a series of strikes against the headquarters, terrorist facilities, and military assets that support Muammar Gaddafi's subversive activities. The attacks were concentrated and carefully targeted to minimize casualties among the Libyan people, with whom we have no quarrel. From initial reports, our forces have succeeded in their mission. Several weeks ago in New Orleans, I warned Colonel Gaddafi we would hold his regime accountable for any new terrorist attacks launched against American citizens. More recently, I made it clear we would respond as soon as we determined conclusively who was responsible for such attacks. On April 5th, in West Berlin, a terrorist bomb exploded in a nightclub frequented by American servicemen. Sergeant Kenneth Ford and a young Turkish woman were killed, and 230 others were wounded, among them some 50 American military personnel. This monstrous brutality is but the latest act in Colonel Gaddafi's reign of terror. The evidence is now conclusive that the terrorist bombing of La Belle Discothèque was planned and executed under the direct orders of the Libyan regime. On March 25th, more than a week before the attack,
now, why did the U.S. bomb Libya in 1986, you might ask? And what was the deal with Reagan and Gaddafi? Here's some intel from NPR's Tom Bowman.
John Kennedy's nemesis was Fidel Castro. For Ronald Reagan, it was Colonel Gaddafi.
I find he's not only a barbarian, but he's flaky.
Some U.S. allies, even a few officials within his own administration, thought President Reagan was too fixated on Gaddafi, that he was building him up. But the president bristled at the Libyan leader's support for terrorist groups and revolutionaries, and he coined a nickname for him.
This mad dog of the Middle East has a goal of a world revolution, Muslim fundamentalist revolution.
The confrontation spanned Reagan's two terms as president. Shortly after he was inaugurated in 1981, President Reagan expelled Libyan diplomats from Washington after reports that Libyan assassination teams were targeting U.S. envoys abroad. That summer, he ordered Navy ships to conduct exercises off the Libyan coast. U.S. warplanes shot down two Libyan aircraft they deemed a threat. The president stepped up economic pressure, too. He barred exports of aircraft parts. Through it all, Gaddafi remained firmly in power, and the president grew more annoyed.
He was somewhat confused. Why weren't we making progress?
Howard Teicher served on Reagan's National Security Council and was in the room for many of the key meetings about Libya.
The president was clearly frustrated that the policies we had taken to confront Gaddafi wherever we could was having relatively limited impact.
Then, in 1986, came the most significant confrontation between Reagan and Gaddafi. It was April. Terrorists bombed the LaBelle discotheque in Berlin.
Three groups have now claimed responsibility for the late-night bomb attack on a disco in Berlin. An investigation.
Two American soldiers were killed. More than 150 people were injured. Speculation centered on a Libyan connection and what the U.S. should do. Some urged caution. Former President Jimmy Carter said the Reagan administration was making a hero out of Gaddafi and increasing the terrorist threat to Americans. Reagan was asked about that at a press conference.
Mr. President, critics say that your policy toward Libya has been too confrontational. President Carter described Colonel Gaddafi as a polecat and said you don't poke a polecat. What do you say to critics who say that military retaliation only begets more violence?
Well, I could answer the other thing, that there's another side of that, that if somebody does this and gets away with it, nothing happens to him. That encourages him to try even harder and do more. And everyone's entitled to call him whatever animal they want, but I think he's more than a bad smell.
The U.S. had intercepted communications between Libyan officials in Tripoli and their agents in Berlin. Gaddafi was behind the attack. Howard Teicher, the White House official, was in the Situation Room when the president decided on a military response.
Reagan would sort of like cock his head a little bit to one side and maybe shut his eyes and look a little disappointed and say, well, I see no alternative but to authorize the action that, you know, you're recommending.
What Reagan authorized became known as Operation El Dorado Canyon. After it was over, the president went on TV to address the nation.
At 7 o'clock this evening, Eastern Time, air and naval forces of the United States launched a series of strikes against the headquarters, terrorist facilities, and military assets that support Muammar Gaddafi's subversive activities. From initial reports, our forces have succeeded in their mission.
Military targets were hit in Tripoli and Benghazi. Libya reported that dozens were killed, including Gaddafi's daughter.
Today, we have done what we had to do. If necessary, we shall do it again.
That wasn't the end of it. 3 years later, in January 1989, two American F-14s engaged in a dogfight with Libyan MiG fighter jets. This is cockpit audio tape from that engagement.
Good deal.
The American fighter jets shot down both Libyan planes. 2 weeks later, Reagan left office. Gaddafi was still in power. Tom Bowman, NPR News, Washington.
Things that make you go,
Okay, so as you could tell from all this hoo-ha, the news did not get a whole lot better that April.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. The Soviet Union confirmed today that a nuclear accident has damaged a reactor in the Ukraine and caused an unspecified number of casualties. The accident, which is believed to have occurred over the weekend, took place at the Chernobyl atomic plant 80 miles north of Kiev. Today's Soviet announcement came after Scandinavian officials reported a large radioactive cloud drifting in from the Soviet Union. Officials believe that cloud poses no threat to residents of Scandinavia. The Environmental Protection Agency says the cloud could reach the U.S. in 5 or 6 days, but officials say they're not sure what impact the fallout will have in this country. Today is the first time the Soviet Union has reported an accident at one of its facilities, although some Western diplomats believe a similar incident occurred nearly 30 years ago in the Ural Mountains.
Here's NPR's Nina Totenberg in a story from that same broadcast.
The Soviets are calling for help
for what they today called a disaster at a nuclear power plant in the Ukraine. The facility is north of the city of Kiev in the center of the USSR's farm belt. Moscow admits that radiation has escaped, that two people have been killed as a result, but one unofficial source put the number of fatalities at 2,000. The Soviets say the radiation leak has been stabilized. Western scientists do not believe that. They suspect a fire in the reactor is still out of control and base their suspicion on Russian requests for assistance. NPR's Neil Conan has been monitoring developments from our London bureau.
There is still very little information available, but the best estimates now are that problems began to develop at one of the four nuclear reactors at Chernobyl sometime late last week. A huge radioactive cloud plumed away to the northeast of the site, which is about 80 miles north of Kiev, the third largest city of the Soviet Union. The first official confirmation only came last night. The official news agency TASS issued a brief item, which was repeated on the English language service of Radio Moscow.
The Soviet government reports an accident at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in the Ukraine, resulting in damage to one of the plant's nuclear reactors. The report says measures are being taken to deal with aftermaths of the accident and help those affected.
That was followed by 24 hours of official silence. Then tonight, there was a statement read out on the evening television news in Moscow. It was the sixth story in the broadcast. The BBC's Peter Ruff was listening.
The statement is unclear about some of the detail, but it indicates that there was an accident which partly destroyed the building housing one of the four nuclear reactors on the site. There was damage to the reactor itself and a subsequent leak of radiation. Two people were killed, and the statement indicates that others have been affected by exposure to radiation. There's no clear information about how many that may be or over how wide an area. The nuclear site has been evacuated along with what are termed three other populated areas. Unconfirmed reports earlier suggested that this may take in an area of 30 square miles. The Council of Ministers statement says the level of radiation has now been stabilized and is being monitored all the time.
Significantly, the statement did not claim that the situation at the reactor is under control. Dr. Thomas Roser, the Secretary General of the West German Nuclear Forum, said that he found two Soviet diplomats at his office in Bonn when he arrived at 8 o'clock this morning and said they wanted information about fires in nuclear reactors and about graphite fires in particular. From the information they gave him, he reached two conclusions.
First of all, that they had a graphite fire in one of their nuclear stations, and we know, in the meantime we know that it's in Chernobyl near Kiev. Secondly, we gathered from the information this graphite fire is still going on.
Graphite is used to control or moderate the chain reaction in a nuclear core. Based on the information provided by the Soviet diplomats and analysis of the radioactive material collected in Sweden, scientists are speculating that there must have been a leak in the supply of water that's used to cool the reactor. That would have exposed uranium fuel rods to the air, which caused them to heat to at least 3,000 degrees centigrade, the temperature required to set the graphite on fire. If the fire is still burning, radiation is still escaping. Dr. Roser said that he and his colleagues were astonished that Soviet authorities had apparently never considered the possibility of a graphite fire, but also said that was typical of the Soviet attitude toward reactor safety.
They have always been saying that the essential thing is good engineering of the machine, and if that is okay, you need not worry about possible consequences, because consequences cannot happen.
If the kind of containment structure that's built around reactors in the West had been in place in Chernobyl, experts say there would have been no significant leak of radiation. I'm Neil Conan, National Public Radio in London.
So it's taken about 25 years, but in that time, we've actually learned a lot about what happened at Chernobyl. Here's NPR's Christopher Joyce with an update.
On those late April days in 1986, plumes of radioactive smoke spread for thousands of square miles across Ukraine, the former Soviet Union, Europe, Scandinavia. Beyond 20 miles or so from the reactor, the doses did not pose an immediate health threat. But what about long-term effects of low-level exposures? Calculations say the accident has and will cause thousands of cancer deaths. But so many people get cancer, it's hard to tease out the extra ones caused by Chernobyl. Radiologist Fred Mettler has been trying to do that with a special United Nations radiation group.
You would have 20 million people over that time dying of cancer generally. Now you're trying to find 4,000 extra cases or 10,000 extra cases. That signal is pretty much too small to actually be able to see.
To really isolate cancers caused by Chernobyl, Mettler says scientists need to know patient histories. Did they smoke, drink heavily, have cancer in the family?
Unfortunately, most of these countries are not sharing their data on health effects back and forth.
Mettler says the easiest Chernobyl cancers to detect are thyroid cancers. Normally, they're rare and are known to be caused by radioactive iodine, of which there was plenty floating around after the accident. Mettler says about 7,000 people got thyroid cancer from the radiation. The vast majority of these have been cured, but there will be more cases. How many more is a mystery.
Because we know it went up in those that were exposed as children, the public and so forth. And it's gone up. We don't know whether that risk is going to go down over time or keep going up or level off. That's probably the biggest thing that's going to be studied and focused on.
Mettler and other scientists say the residents who've moved back, as well as the hundreds of thousands of so-called liquidators who returned to clean up the site, are a potential goldmine of information. They are the only large population of people exposed to low levels of radiation since the Japanese survivors at Nagasaki and Hiroshima. But finding them, their medical records, or the money to do the research is doubtful. What worries some health professionals more than radiation are the psychological effects of the accident. James Smith, a physicist at the University of Portsmouth who has studied Chernobyl for two decades, says several studies found high rates of suicide, depression, and mental health problems in the region after Chernobyl.
Having to live with radiation, knowing that you've been exposed, gives an additional psychological stress because the information hasn't always been reliable, so people don't always know what the risk to their health really is.
And Smith says Chernobyl remains an open sore for Ukraine. The government is trying to raise hundreds of millions of dollars to construct a huge building that will cover the crumbling concrete sarcophagus that now keeps the highly radioactive plant isolated. And then there's the radiation that's still locked up in the environment, largely out of sight but potentially dangerous. For example, there's lots of long-lasting cesium bound up in the forests and soil around the plant. Chad Oliver is a forestry professor at Yale University who's been there.
The forests have been crowded and untended, and they're on soils and in a climate that they could very well go up in a catastrophic fire, similar to our Western fires. The problem with the catastrophic fires is that they even create their own weather patterns, so you get some very tremendous dispersion of smoke.
The radioactive smoke might not be deadly as far as the city of Kiev, about 100 miles away, but the local effects could be very dangerous.
The worst concern is the firefighters that are going in there would be inhaling that close. It would be quite concentrated radioactive smoke.
Oliver says the firefighting equipment near the site is outdated and the roads are poor. Recently, though, the U.S. Forest Service has been pitching in. Teams from the service are advising Ukraine on how to cull trees and remove downed wood to lower the fire hazard. They're also studying wind and weather patterns in case another conflagration hits Chernobyl. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
How do you follow a piece about Chernobyl? Why, singer Tom Waits, of course.
And you comb your hair.
Tom Waits claims to have been born in the back of a taxi in 1947. He's not free with details about his early life, except to say that his first musical influence was his Uncle Robert, who played organ at the Methodist Church.
When I was a kid, I just wanted to smoke cigars and break windows and stay up late.
Waits says his friends were into the Beach Boys. He discovered his parents' collection of Cole Porter and Gershwin tunes. His favorite childhood movie was The Beast with Five Fingers.
That hand that came back from the grave and played the piano. Dude. I saw The Pawnbroker on the bill with, I think it was 101 Dalmatians. And that was really a shock. But I used to... I went to the movies like everybody else, but you know, it was more of a place to go to, you know, meet girls, and, you know, I wasn't, like, interested in cinema or anything. I was interested in sitting in the dark. Yeah, that interested me.
The beginning of the 70s found Tom Waits playing in Hollywood night spots like The Troubadour, where he was discovered on Amateur Night and later signed to Elektra Asylum. Stories quickly circulated about this strange cat who lived in flop houses and sang with a cigarette stuck to his lip.
A sight for sore eyes, it's a long time no see. Working hard, hardly working. Hey man, you know me. Water under the bridge. Did you see my new car? Well, it's bought and it's paid for. Parked outside of the bar. Any barkeeper, what's keeping?
Waits created a hard drinking, wild living stage persona. A guy who looked like he crawled out of a bottle and might crawl back in any minute. Like so many performers, soon his life was imitating his act.
Well, nobody goes out there alone. You know, people change their name. That's the smartest thing to do, because you start, you don't know who the hell you are. And pretty soon people start criticizing you and taking pictures of you and telling their friends about you. And it's very confusing. You know, somebody tell you you're big in Belgium and you're doing well on the coast, and you got this thing happening here, and you got a new, it's like spreading yourself out, and it's very disorienting.
Because the piano has been drinking, the piano has been drinking, the piano has been drinking, not me, not me, not me, not me, not me.
As the 70s wore on, you could find Tom Waits' name on almost anybody's most likely to die young list. He was the perfect rock and roll fantasy, a cult hero who'd never had a hit record. Cynics said what he really needed to hit the big time was to be found dead in a hotel room. But Tom Waits had other ideas. He got married, quit smoking, and had babies, four of them in the last 6 years.
Well, I only see the children on the holidays now that they're in military school, so. Yes, thank you. And, of course, they're heavily insured, so we look forward to a real good year. Thank you, dear.
He got himself a homemade special. You know his glass is full of sand. And it feels just like a jaybird. The way it fits into his hand. He rolled a blade up in his trick towel.
So far this year, Tom Waits has worked with Jim Jarmusch, the director of Stranger Than Paradise, on a film called Down by Law. And he's produced the critically acclaimed Rain Dogs album, a 19-song example of the diversity of his writing talent. Now, he's taking on a new challenge, rehearsing in Chicago for his first live stage performance as an actor in Frank's Wild Years, a play co-written with his wife and based on this improvised bit of neo-beat poetry from Waits' 1985 album, Swordfish Trombones. From Al's Cafe in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Proffitt.
Frank settled down out in the valley, and he hung his wild years on a nail that he drove through his wife's forehead. He sold used office furniture out there on San Fernando Road and assumed a $30,000 loan at 15.25%, put a down payment on a little two-bedroom place. His wife was a spent piece of used jet trash, made good Bloody Marys, kept her mouth shut most of the time, had a little chihuahua named Carlos that had some kind of skin disease and was totally blind. They had a thoroughly modern kitchen, self-cleaning oven, the whole bit. Frank drove a little sedan. They were so happy. One night, Frank was on his way home from work. He stopped at the liquor store, picked up a couple of Mickey's Big Mouths, drank them in the car on the way to the Shell station.
had a gallon of gas in a can. Drove home, doused everything in the house, and torched it. Parked across the street laughing, watching it burn, all Halloween orange and chimney red. And Frank put on a top 40 station, got on the Hollywood freeway and headed north. Never could stand that dog.
Songwriter Harold Arlen passed away in April 86, and I hesitated to include this story at the risk of continuing in Debbie Downer mode, but this is something I remember even hearing as it was broadcast, and it's quite uplifting, really.
Let's fall in love, why shouldn't we fall in love? Our hearts are made of it, let's take a chance, why be afraid of it?
In 1920, 15-year-old Harold Arlen dropped out of high school in Buffalo, New York. He wanted to become a musician, and he did. He got to Tin Pan Alley in the 20s. He played the piano and sang. He could read music, and he could write it. Harold Arlen wrote some of this country's most singable, hummable, and lasting popular songs, more than 500, including the 1939 ballad, Over the Rainbow. That melody came to him as he and his wife drove to a movie. His wife said that he wrote down the notes gratefully. Harold Arlen died yesterday at his home in Manhattan. He was 81 years old. He was a soft-spoken man and not as famous as some of his peers. But you'll probably find yourself singing one of these songs today and tomorrow.
Forget your troubles, come on, get happy. You better chase all your cares away. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. Get ready for the judgment day. The sun is shining, come on, get happy. The Lord is waiting to take your hand. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. We're going to the promised land. You got to accent. To A, the positive, and eliminate the negative, and latch on to the affirmative, but don't mess with Mr. In Between. Ah.
I don't know why there's no sun up in the sky, stormy weather, since my man and I ain't together. Raining all the time.
Say it's only a paper moon sailing over a cardboard sea, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. When a bee lies sleeping in the palm of your hand, you're bewitched and deep in love's long looked after land, where you'll see a sun-up sky with a morning new, and where the days go laughing by as love comes a-calling on you.
Okay, so I know we said we'd do the NPR 40th anniversary shindig thing this month, but the real anniversary is actually in May. The first broadcast, May 3rd, 1971. So look for a big NPR party in our May episode. Special thanks this month go to NPR's very own Michael Katziff. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.
You've had
happy little bluebirds fly beyond the